Hello?
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 You pod.
To win the game. That's the great thing about sports.
You pod to win the game.
All right, welcome into You Pod to Win the Game. I am Charles Robinson, senior NFL writer for Yahoo Sports. Sorry for the head cold. I have been on the road for a bit, and so I'm going to sound a little bit stuffed up in this show. But thankfully, we have a good lineup walking us through it. Been through a few camps. We're going to have Arif Hassan in, who covers the Vikings for The Athletic. We got Jory Epstein, who covers the Cowboys for USA Today and also the broader NFL. And then Mike Kliss, who's the Denver Broncos insider for 9 News in Denver. It's going to be a heck of a show. We're also going to sprinkle in a little bit of talk about the Stephen Ross suspension, which obviously was the huge news across the NFL on Tuesday, as well as touch a little bit on Deshaun Watson, what's expected coming on Thursday. So hang with us. Sorry about the cold again, and hopefully you enjoy the show. All right, I want to welcome in Arif Hassan. Welcome from The Athletic, covers the Minnesota Vikings. It is great to have you on. I mean, you and I were just talking. It's the first time I think we've officially met, although we followed each other on Twitter for a pretty long time.
Yeah, for a decent while.
Yeah, for sure.
I remember going back and forth with you about who visited the Vikings back in the, I think Mike Zimmer's first, coaching free agency. So, you know, way back, right?
Mike Zimmer. Yeah, that's an era that we will get to Mike Zimmer in that bygone era of Minnesota Vikings football, which I'm very curious to hear what you think of the vibe. But I had to ask you, obviously news of the day, the NFL drops the investigation into the Miami Dolphins after Brian Flores made a number of accusations toward the organization about tampering, incentivized losing, a number of different things. And it was funny because the investigation kind of went away for a little while. Like, we kept asking questions, kept asking Roger, like, where's this at? Got a lot of vague responses. And then all of a sudden, in a drop where we're all waiting for Deshaun Watson news, the league surprises all of us. It says, hey, guess what? The Miami Dolphins, they f***ed up. they're in some trouble here. And for those who are not caught up on it, and I'm sure everyone is at this point, the league found the Miami Dolphins and owner Stephen Ross, another executive in the organization, committed multiple acts of tampering from 2019-2021 with Tom Brady and Sean Payton. Well, Brady was a member of the New England Patriots and also the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Payton was head coach of the New Orleans Saints. Part of the fallout here, the Dolphins are going to lose their 2023 first-round pick and a third-rounder in 2024. But what I thought was a really interesting takeaway in all this, and this was something that you alluded to in your tweets today, they believed everything Brian Flores said, except for the one part about incentivized losing that strikes at the integrity of the league. They said, well, and I'm paraphrasing here, maybe people misunderstood things that were said.
Right, yeah.
We're not saying it wasn't said, but it wasn't really serious and it wasn't really accepted as something that was serious. So really, they're not denying that it happened, but they're kind of denying that the owner was serious about it when he said it. Convenient. It's a very convenient.
Yeah, extremely convenient. I think they used, one of the words that they used was, context. As people viewed these statements in different contexts. And it's like, man, I don't know, man. My boss offers me $100,000 to do something. I'm seriously considering doing something like that. That if I do it and my boss doesn't pony up, then I'm pretty upset. When you're in that position, when you're an owner, like, obviously you need to develop a relationship, right? As an employer with your employees. And a lot of times that can include jokes, but you have to be really careful about kind of what that entails.
Right.
When you bring those jokes into the actual structured relationship that you have, there's not room for jokes. Like, I'm sorry, that's ridiculous. So I find that really funny, especially because this was apparently a persistent joke, right? That Stephen Ross would continue to surround himself with people in the front office and be like, man, wouldn't it be great if we lost? Not saying, please don't do, but well, how funny would that be?
Well, and then they're like, the league admits like, well, Stephen Ross did make some comments. And again, this is paraphrasing here, but they, did make some comments about prioritizing draft position in the franchise. And then they point out, but he never said that again after Brian Flores had written a memo about it in the franchise. Stephen Ross never mentioned again after that. Well, yeah, of course You're not going to mention it again. Once your head coach is upset enough to commit it to writing in the franchise, an owner probably catches on at that point and goes, that's a paper trail. Maybe I should stop talking about this.
Right. Like there's not a ton of crimes where if you stop a crime because someone told you to stop, it retroactively erases the actual criminal history. Right. Like that just doesn't, like, it's not how that works.
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing is just, it's interesting. The league was, I guess, as open as they could be about as egregious as this is. Stephen Ross, obviously right. having a front seat role in all this. The 2019 dalliance with Brady when he was a member of the Patriots. Once again in 2021 when he was a member of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And then obviously the Sean Payton tampering when Sean was the head coach of the Saints. I'll tell you what, I'm pretty pissed at Stephen Ross if I'm Robert Kraft or I'm in the Glazer family or you're obviously
whichever Loomis is set or yeah, whoever's set to take over for the Saints.
Yeah. Whoever's going to take over, Rita Benson. I mean, like you're sitting there and you're saying like, particularly Kraft, you think of 2019, you're trying to hold together this marriage of Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. You're doing what you can to try and, soothe it over. If anyone's read Seth Wickersham's book, It's Better to Be Feared, you kind of saw how waist deep he was in the middle of what was kind of a marriage going really wrong. And then right in the middle of it, Stephen Ross is basically trying to figure out how do I get this guy away from the Patriots, and it's remarkable to me that you could run afoul of so many different owners. And as you and I know, owners can be punitive. I'm very curious.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. You got to believe.
Right.
Like Robert Kraft's probably not going to let this go, right? I mean, it won't be anything on right. Front Street, but I got to believe he's going to hold this against Stephen.
Oh, Ross. Yeah. Well, especially like if you're pissing off like a Kraft or a Rooney or somebody who's got like a lot of sway and influence right. inside the NFL, because not all owners are treated the same right. in terms of the influence that they have. Like there's just going to be some stuff coming your way. And a lot of owners, they're not all Jerry Jones. You're not going to see it right away, right? Like you might find a rule change in 3 years that's absolutely going to fuck you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, absolutely.
And so that's how a lot of this stuff, gets played out. So I'm kind of curious to see the fallout. If, we ever see a fallout that we can identify that they can't, right? Because they play games that like, I'm not a billionaire, right? Like, I don't know what kind of social signals you need to send in order to play some of these games. But yeah, this is a lot, I think, to take in. And I think also part of that might have motivated the severity of the punishment. Like, not that, tampering doesn't historically carry, the cost of a first round pick. I mean, it has in the past, but it still seems like a lot, especially the $1.5 million fine for Ross, as well as a $500,000 fine, I believe, to assistant general manager. I don't quite remember the specifics of that one. But the heaviness of those fines, as well as the additional third round pick and just the overall severity, might either allude to, hey, we can't really tick off Kraft too much when we lay down this punishment and be too light. Or it might allude to, yeah, okay, we're not punishing them for tanking because that would admit that the integrity of the league is at risk.
Right.
But, maybe just push a little bit more on this other punishment. Maybe you can kind of get the message.
And they're not allowed at league meetings. That was my favorite. Yeah. Oh, geez. We're not going to let you into the league meetings, which I'm like, most of those guys don't want to be there anyway.
Right.
So I don't know how severe, unless you're really doing, the TV contracts are done pretty much. Obviously Sunday tickets got to be, there's no CBA negotiation going on.
Right.
Pretty
much. And the Sunday ticket that's going to be hammered out.
Yeah. There's a lot of autopilot going on right now. I'm sure he's not going to miss a lot, missing some of the owners' meetings. One thing that is a sidelight out of this that I thought was kind of interesting, though, is, well, really two sidelights. Number one, the Tom Brady retirement was bullshit. Like, it's all aired out now. Like, that was total garbage.
Yeah.
We know what was going on now. And, Tom kind of playing it off was just BS. So that was one thing I thought was interesting. Number two, the fact that Tom Brady and Sean Payton are not getting hit in this, which, I mean, who typically doesn't get hit in investigation? The collaborators, right? So I don't know what they did or what Don Yee, their agent, did to kind of remove them from the blast radius of this, which I think is really interesting. And then the third thing, you lose a first round pick and, Tua, it kind of helps Tua a little bit.
Right?
Like, perfect. It takes a draft asset off the table they could have used to either draft another quarterback or package to replace Tua. And in a weird way, it might sort of help him potentially get an extra year because now they don't have two first round picks to play with in what's going to be a strong quarterback draft.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that was kind of one of the things that, not that Tua was particularly at risk in this year's draft or anything like that, but the weakness of that quarterback class, I think, is kind of one thing that kind of helped motivate the Dolphins to be like, yeah, well, yeah, we'll see what it's like when Tua doesn't have like 80 RPOs to work off of the game. Right. So, you know, I think I don't know if Tua is singing about this. I don't know if that's how he views it, but certainly I think that he should at least pop some champagne.
You got to be, you know, you're sitting there and you're like, okay, well, so my former head coach, Brian Flores, tried to replace me with a guy who had oodles of civil suits, you know, pending against him. And he tried to replace me with that guy. And then my owner tried to replace me with a dude who's, granted, he's the GOAT, but he's also in his mid-40s. You know, you're probably like, all right, well, at least it was Brady. You know, at least it was, you know, on the field, Deshaun Watson's a pretty good player. So at least they're trying to replace me with high-level guys. But it can't be the best feeling on earth to know that both the owner and the former head coach were trying to figure out how they could supplant Tua at the quarterback.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the on-field potential of Tua. I wrote a recent article about that, actually. But by all accounts, Tua is like a phenomenal human being.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like just a wonderful guy. And I feel bad.
Yeah, he's going through it.
He constantly gets roped into this sort of thing.
Yeah. I don't know that anybody really deserves this, to be honest with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's good, though, that we're talking about quarterbacks because I had a chance to swing into to Vikings camp briefly, you know, meet Kevin O'Connell, meet with Kwesi Adofo-Mensah. Unfortunately, I plan on watching practice and then, because of the Deshaun Watson situation, yanked away in the morning. And then in the afternoon I got yanked away again. But I did want to talk to you about the organization, just sort of the change now, Mike Zimmer being gone and maybe what the vibes are like with a guy like Kevin O'Connell, obviously very young, very different human being than a Mike Zimmer, going to have I would think a very different relationship with Kirk Cousins, not only just from the standpoint of kind of what had transpired between Mike and Kirk, but obviously the fact that Kirk has some background with Kevin O'Connell going back to 2017 with Washington's franchise. But I'm curious what you think of the feel of this new, not only front office and coaching staff, but I guess really what they're bringing to the table. What is not, we don't see often where a head coach and a GM are replaced and it's not a reboot situation. This is clearly not a reboot situation.
Yeah. Well, so part of it is just to speak to the GM thing, is that until like the very last moments, there was kind of an understanding that Rick Spielman might actually retain his job.
Right.
And it wasn't until kind of, you know, the final moments, which I don't know all of the details of, honestly, that they decided to kind of move on from Rick Spielman and expand, you know, their new search to include a general manager. So that's kind of part of it, is that it's not, you know, quite the normal situation to do kind of the double replacement there. But, you know, on top of that, it is about kind of establishing a culture that they're very comfortable with, they can move forward with. And obviously for that, it would help to replace the front office. But, you know, primarily for that, the head coach, you have to have kind of a culture shift, which is why basically every candidate you saw for head coach would have represented a significant cultural shift in a lot of ways, right? They weren't all offensive guys, but they certainly all carried a more player-forward approach to the way that they coach. You hear every time there's a new coaching staff with the team, I'm sure you hear it all the time doing national work, you always hear the word collaboration come up. Yeah. But certainly they've instituted mechanisms for collaboration to, I think, become a reality instead of a buzzword. So you've got that in there, at least. And that, I think, has created an atmosphere. First, just the fact that you're not in a lame duck season. That atmospheric shift alone, I think, for a lot of players and a lot of people throughout the building, it's just like a weight lifted off your shoulders. It's just like much easier to go into work. But then also kind of affirmatively, the kind of atmosphere that Kevin O'Connell brings forward, it very much seems like there's kind of a re-energization, right, of the building and of practices. And, you know, there's something different about fighting for your job, knowing that the person making that decision won't necessarily be there next year, and fighting for your job, knowing that that person's going to be there for a while, right? Or knowing that your job is secure as opposed to insecure because, you know, the guy designing the offense isn't going to be there. So that kind of level of stress is kind of removed. I think that the kind of the joie de vivre of having a young coach, the kind of the way that that carries itself through, that is present to me in practice. Like, it's always difficult to judge kind of the atmosphere or the vibe of a practice, especially before the season starts. They haven't lost any games yet. But certainly, I think that there is kind of a renewed enthusiasm about the way that they're approaching these things.
Yeah, and something interesting about Kevin, too, is how legitimately close he and Sean McVay really were down the stretch in LA. Like, it was really, he was a touchstone of sorts for Sean McVay. And I think in a number of things, you know, I went through camp earlier with the Rams, and McVay talked about the times where, like, legitimately he wasn't loving coaching as much as he was used to loving it. And there was more of a grind and more of a micromanaging. And I think some of the time when he was sort of sorting out his feelings and his struggles, he leaned on Kevin O'Connell quite a bit. So this is a young guy who comes into Minnesota having front row seats for what another young, very successful coach, how he succeeded, but also how he started to struggle and try to reinvent himself in the middle of it, which I think is really valuable, you know, for the Vikings. I'm curious from a quarterback standpoint, and, you know, there was obviously the recent news blew up kind of nationally there, some remarks that Kwesi Adofo-Mensah had said about speaking in general, what he says were generalities about quarterbacks, and then sort of the Rams window and all these things. Mm-hmm. But I will say this, there are two individuals who I think it's interesting that Kevin went through a situation where he saw Sean assess the abilities of a quarterback who's expected to be the cornerstone or someone he wanted to succeed with, and then pivot away from it when he felt like, I see an upgrade here. Let's always keep our, you know, the door open on an upgrade at that position because it's necessary to always be competitive for Super Bowls. And then, you know, even Kwesi, although it was brief, it's not like he spent a ton of time in Cleveland. I do think it's interesting, though, that he is very closely associated with Andrew Berry, who this offseason made arguably the most aggressive move in the history of the quarterback position to not only pay Deshaun Watson, but give him a massive amount of money in a contract and then, you know, back him up until this point through what right now, at least we think could be a 6-game suspension. So you have these two guys that are now leading this Vikings organization. I wonder how that will impact Kirk, who is obviously on a 2-year deal now. And I think they kind of look at it, at least from what I was able to assess, is that it's sort of, they feel like, hey, this is a partnership. We went in, we thought, okay, we got a 2-year partnership with this guy. We're going to see what we can do with him. We're going to see what Kevin can create, whether there is a higher ceiling here that Kevin can help him get to. But I also, and this is me speaking here, I have to believe coming out of the organizations that they did and the people that they're close to in the league, it's sort of a 2-year window that I think during that 2-year window, they're also going to be working out other potential options.
Absolutely. No, that's a good point that you bring up, that, you know, both of them come from organizations that wouldn't settle at the quarterback position, right? That they, and it is, and Adofo-Mensah, actually the day after, you know, the first day that we got his availability, when we asked him about the USA Today piece, you know, one of the things he said is, yeah, my wife keeps telling me I have to say less. Stop. Right?
Yeah, like, don't talk so much.
Yeah, right. So he felt he was maybe being a little bit too open, but there's a couple of things that stick out. Of course, he prioritizes the importance of the quarterback position and how they, you know, define team success, but he also pointed out, like, hey, there's two things, you know, I'm kind of chained to here. First is the certainty of having that kind of high floor at quarterback that it's difficult to move from, that it is an immensely scary venture to try and, you know, get past that. But second, when you know you don't have a Tom Brady or a Patrick Mahomes, I think is the phrase that he uses, you know, you have to kind of build around that. And, you know, that tells you obviously very much correctly view Kirk Cousins, a very good quarterback that is not at that upper echelon where you can kind of rely on him to consistently produce, you know, or create wins when wins aren't already there. Right. And so knowing that that's the case, and knowing that, you know, both organizations moved on from maybe Jared Goff isn't a high floor quarterback, but a very, you know, somewhat stable quarterback. Right. And then Mayfield, who, the injury complicates things, but honestly, you know, I don't actually think he's a bad quarterback. I think he's fine.
It's just uneven, right? It was an uneven performance.
Yeah, uneven, right. Yeah. To go in all in, basically, essentially, like you said, for the quarterback position, I think tells us that, you know, when they signed, so to cut myself off, when they signed the 2-year extension with Kirk Cousins, I didn't necessarily view it as a certainty that he'd be here for 2 years, right? Because a 1 year contract is very tradable.
Right.
And a quarterback is a great asset to trade away just as much as it is to trade for. And so they might do something along the lines of Mayfield or Goff, where you've got, you know, quarterback that still has years left on the contract or a year left on the contract, trade them away. If you've got an opportunity to upgrade at the quarterback position, I don't know what quarterbacks would be available, right, you know, a year from now, but you know, these things are kind of fluid apparently in the NFL, more fluid than I ever remember them being. So this is certainly a situation where I don't think the Vikings are going to cement themselves, maybe the best way to put it, to definitely 2 years of Kirk Cousins. But it's a great fallback plan, a better fallback plan than most teams have if they want to kind of remain competitive and so on. And then if after 2 years it doesn't work, you know, I think they have an understanding, you know, ownership is going to be like, well, you know, we all agree that this was worth a try.
Right.
And now you have an opportunity to define what the team looks like going forward.
Yeah, you've put it on a timetable where there shouldn't be any regrets. So if it doesn't work out, you took your shot. There's nothing Kirk should be upset about. I mean, paid fabulously over the years. I mean, he's going to, you know, he'll leave with plenty of money and still be a viable starter somewhere in the NFL. But yeah, I mean, I think it's as you said, the fact that it could be maybe a 1 year marriage where they look at it, see what Kevin O'Connell can do with him. If it's sort of what we know about Kirk Cousins, if the story has sort of told itself and it doesn't change dramatically with a different, you know, coach there leading him, then it makes all the sense in the world to, you know, again, going back to the organizations that these guys hail from most recently, see if there's an upgrade. You know, I mean, that was one of the things that McVay said about moving off of Goff was like, not like we thought we were going to do that, but we were always like, hey, if by some chance this presents itself, we have to be able to consider it. And you put it perfectly. I'm with you. Like, there was not fluidity like this. Like, a couple, it was like 3 years ago, we all would have looked at each other like, no, I mean, you know, I mean, come on, like, quarterbacks don't move around. I mean, that's not
right
now, you know.
Quarterbacks didn't move around. And then last year, we're like, is Aaron Rodgers going to go to Denver?
And then it's like, no, it's Russell Wilson. And we're like, oh, okay. So,
of course.
Yeah, you're absolutely. Right, yeah. That's the crazy thing. We don't know. There was literally a year, and it wasn't that long ago, that if someone had said to you or I, well, you know, the Eagles are going to move on from Carson Wentz and the Rams are going to move on from Jared Goff, we'd have been like, you're on crack. Like, that's not going to happen. But now it's changed. And I think it's another thing that's fascinating about it, too, is, I mean, I don't want to play too much on the youth thing, but I do feel like we are seeing more of an element. And I think the Vikings are now part of this. We're seeing younger coaches and younger general managers who are not necessarily the, hey, I've been grinding it out for, you know, 25 years. I was an area scout, then I was this scout, and I was over the top, you know, and move my way up, and I won't move off of players now. I think now we're starting to see a little bit of a younger generation and younger coaching staffs that are like, hey, yeah, you know, like, we don't have to be married to this. And you and I have done this long enough that there's, again, no more. It's a one-year plan. Everything's a one-year plan now. It used to be.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, you hear Kwesi talk about the way you construct a team. He keeps on using phrases that he's picked up from his time in finance. One of those phrases is time horizons, which is about the time that you would expect, like, say, a stock to mature. He's using it basically to mean what our window is, or essentially what we expect the plan to look like or the team to look like 1 year, 2 years, 3 years from now. But, you know, when you get a return on investment. And it very much is clear to me that as much as he rejects this characterization, he's been very strenuous about it. It's clear to me that he does view players as assets, right? You know, he rejects it because it's like kind of dehumanizing and it doesn't really allow you to build connections with players. But like, that is very much how he has talked about, in a very roundabout way, a lot of the ways that you manage an organization were to kind of maximize what your goal is, which in this case is wins. And so that's on the table. And like you said, you know, throughout the league, you've got, you know, younger general managers, right? Like, it's not just, you know, in Minnesota, right? You've got, like, you know, Sirianni, right? For example, or not Sirianni, sorry. You've got, like, Casario, right? And you've got, you know, some of these other younger general managers just kind of popping up around the league.
Omar Khan, I mean, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And even Andrew Berry isn't, like, you know, he didn't go through the same path that, you know, Spielman did. You know, it's I wouldn't say jumping the line, because it implies that succession is like a reasonable model by which you should view organizations. And I don't think it is, but certainly to some of these guys, it must seem like jumping the line, right? Where somebody gets to prove that they've got a new innovative take on the way to manage an organization. They can build those relationships and build models and stuff like that. And so an owner takes a chance on them. So I think that the fluidity is maybe a product of the way that the coaching and front office culture has changed to be a little bit more NBA-like, to understand that, you know, you can really quickly assemble a team that might be successful and get you to your goal, or you can quickly jettison a team that you can tell is not going to get you there.
Do you think, you know, them both being so young, there is a learning curve? And again, having gone through Rams camp and talked to McVay about loving it and then kind of not loving it and trying to reinvent it and coming up with this idea of being top heavy, which wasn't how they started. They weren't immediately like, hey, we're just going to be a top heavy organization.
Right.
It developed quickly, but I don't think they went into it going, we're going to have superstars at six positions. And then, you know, this very young spine of the roster where coaches are going to have to play a lot of young guys, but they learned as they went. What is your sense of sort of the learning curve there? I sort of took it as, particularly what happened with Kwesi, very honest, clearly an honest guy. And that showcases itself where all of a sudden people are like, he's, you know, wait, he said what? And even if you, the way I absorbed what he had said in the USA Today piece, I was kind of like, yeah. Like, I was like, yeah, this.
Oh, yeah. You know, I read that and yeah. I was like, oh, that's going to cause sparks. But it's not like he's wrong.
But he's not wrong.
Anything he
said.
Yeah,
no, I didn't. Right, yeah. I was like, he just said things that, you know, feel honest. And
right. Well, I mean, if you ask Kirk Cousins, do you think that you're at the level of Tom Brady and Patrick Mahomes? He would agree that he's not, right? Like he's very honest.
And
about
let's be honest, let's say he disagreed and thought what would we do? We would all be like, "Are you? Come on, man! Like, are you kidding? Like, right? We would have killed him for it." It's like, you're damned if you do, or you're damned if you don't. You say the truth right. About what the talent. You know, I mean, you're right, but I'm sorry, I mean to cut you off, but yeah, I mean, I would hope Kirk recognizes, like, yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Like,
no, for sure. I think that there, to speak to your point about kind of the learning curve, especially for a younger coach that hasn't had, or a younger front office that hasn't had a ton of time and a ton of organizations, I think you see it here and there. Nothing that like feels catastrophic that's going to lose them a game. But every so often there's like a misstep here that, you know, a veteran coach would have avoided. There's, you know, this small thing here or there. I don't want to get into too many details because a lot of them, you know, were like in confidence, but it's just like minor missteps where it's just like, oh, he didn't even know that as a head coach that's his job now.
Right.
Right. And you know, there are some things where he does stuff that, you know, you don't, that I at least haven't seen head coaches do, that I really appreciate. Like for today, for example, in the availability, you know, we were scheduled to get the offensive coordinator, Wes Phillips. And, you know, previously yesterday, Irv Smith had left practice and the news eventually came out that it was because he'd injured his thumb. He has thumb surgery. They expect him back by, you know, the season opener. I think that's optimistic. But what had happened was that we would have asked, and I think any other team, we would have asked the person most closely associated with that player in the availability about the injury, in which case is the offensive coordinator. We would ask him, and, you know, they don't always know what they're, you know, allowed to say and stuff like
right.
that. Right?
Right.
And in previous coaching, like that just happens. And they would probably just say, well, you know, that's an injury. I can't really speak to it, whatever. Instead, Kevin O'Connell was just like, hey, you're going to ask questions about Wes Phillips. I don't want him to have to, you know, figure out what he can and can't say. So I'm just going to tell you, I'm not going to take any questions. Here's what and I love that. I don't think that's standard practice, but that's great. Right. And so, you know, there's some things where as a new coach, he breaks convention that he doesn't really know what coaches do. And that's really phenomenal. Other times, you know, he makes mistakes. Like, you know, the Vikings asked fans to not take video of practice. And it's like, what, that's not going to work. Now, I don't know what you're going to get out of that. And immediately fans started taking video. And I think the most entertaining part of that is that other people were using that video and mapping it directly onto McVay playbooks that had already leaked. Like it's even worse than you thought it was going to be.
Right.
So, you know, there's just all these things here or there. You know, he might be 5 minutes late because he doesn't realize as a head coach, he has to do this, or as a general manager, he doesn't realize, you know, hey, you know, by the numbers, that's a great trade, but now you have set what your market looks like going forward. And you're going to undercut your ability to make, you know, first round trades and get the most bang for your buck there, right? You know, that sort of thing where it's just like, if you'd been in a front office longer, you had more experience, you would know that even though in the moment this seems like kind of normal, the realities of the NFL, as crazy as it is, as unusual and unintuitive, you know, the NFL is, these are, the, you know, there are certain ways that you do things that have a fundamental underlying reason to it, but you can't immediately figure out why that's the case. And so there are all kinds of small minor missteps. Again, they're not really going to amount to much, you know, good or bad, but they just lead to moments where you're just like, oh yeah, okay, well, he hasn't even been in organizations all that long. That, you know, he was a quarterback not that long ago, right? And so he just doesn't realize, hey, you can't be breaking film down right now. They just signed somebody. You're going to have to talk to us about it.
Right.
You know, that
right.
sort of thing.
What, this is the last question. I'll get you out of here. I'm curious. Look, pads are just coming on, you know. Yep. It's always hard when people ask you, you know, you go, and particularly like me, I go through and I see just a tiny snapshot. You know far more about the Vikings than I ever could. But people always want to go, what do they look like? And you're like, well, the pads aren't even on yet. Like, I literally have no clue. I mean, they're running around in, you know, shells and nothing else. And I guess you can tell me whether or not my perception is accurate here. I look at the roster, it's talented. Okay. And we'll see what happens with Kirk and obviously the change in staff and what that can ultimately, but I feel like, hey, if they can get something out of Kirk that is an upgrade over maybe what has happened in previous years. Not that he's, you know, he's been middle of the road. I think like decent, you know, okay starter. I think if they can upgrade that, to me, when I look at the division, you know, hey, Green Bay is Green Bay, but I think it's a team that right. I think should be able to be pretty competitive. And the NFC, frankly, when I look at it, is a mess. You know, the AFC is a meat grinder. The NFC, I'm just like, who the hell knows what's going to happen here?
Yeah, no, I think that it makes sense to have positive expectations. I mean, you take an offense that by a lot of measures, especially, you know, some of the advanced metrics, is flirting with the top 10, if not in the top 10. You have an opportunity to upgrade it to maybe top 8. And if you're just really lucky, top 5. And you get that. And then you move the defense from wherever they are, 30th, 29th, 28th last year, I think 27th in some metrics. You move that up to 16th. And now you're a playoff team, right? Especially in the NFC, where there's just this weird garbled mess. On top of that, the Vikings were in, I want to say 15 one-score games last year out of 17. I think they tied the league record for most one-score games. And they were about even in one-score games. So it's not like you've got this like Bill Barnwell luck calculation right. that you're moving one way or the other. But, you know, if you marginally improve the team over that, right, that's a bunch of wins that, because if you add 2 points a game, now the Vikings are in the playoffs, right. not even close, right? And so there are small margins to be gained here for the Vikings that I think are truer for the Vikings than they are for other teams. But a lot of it is just not making mistakes, right? Because the Vikings had the worst end of half defense in NFL history. I think if you equalized every team's end of half and end of game, you know, 2 minute drill, which obviously it's its own skill. You can't just get rid of it. But for context, I mean, the Vikings would have been like 15-2. Right. Like it's a wild situation for them to be as good as they were in certain elements of the game and then be as bad as they were in very small slices of the game. And so there's a lot of opportunity for those margins to add up. Now, I think that there's also going to be a pretty big drop off, right? Because I think that no matter what happens in some other areas, right? Because no matter what happens, Mike Zimmer, no matter what you think of him as a head coach or the way that he restricts the offense, he was a brilliant defensive mind right. and he continued yeah. to be a brilliant defensive mind. And I think that even though the defense ranked where it did, it mostly did that because of end of half stuff. And if you look at the rest of the, it was actually a pretty good defense, especially in the first half of the season before Danielle Hunter got hurt. I don't think you can replicate that. I have a lot of respect for Ed Donatell, but Mike Zimmer, I think, is on another plane as a defensive mind. And I think there's just going to be struggles defensively that you're going to have to make up for. So there are opportunities for a drop off, especially with a first year coach, that might make up for some of these gains that you're going to get marginally that will improve things. And so while I think the team overall is going to improve, I think it's very easy to take a look at the roster, say that's talented. Now, if we assume Kirk is a little bit better, they're a playoff team. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. And this sort of uncertainty always makes it difficult to project. To me, they're a 10 or 11 win team, which I believe hits the over. Yeah, so, yeah. you know, go ahead and, but, you know, yeah, go ahead. You know, don't bill me. I think it hits the over. I think it sneaks them into the playoffs. And I think that there's not much after that. They get into the playoffs and they have a little fun and then they get to watch the Super Bowl from home.
Well, I mean, you know, there's probably an underrated element too of young staffs is it usually takes a year or two for the staff to dial in yeah. the staff, you know, there's going right, to be, exactly, going yeah. to be different assistants and, you know, we'll see at times coordinators get swapped out. And so even that's a process, but Well, Arif, I appreciate you taking the time with us, man. I know, ran a little bit long here, but I'm really glad we got a chance to talk about not only the Vikings, but obviously everything that went down in Miami as well. So hang in, and hopefully we can have you back on at some point during the course of the season. We can talk about all the great things that Kevin O'Connell and
all the innovations.
Yeah, everything. They've reinvented the NFC. All right, we're joined by Jory Epstein, who works for USA Today, covering the Cowboys, but also the league. It's good to have you in, and, it's a good time to have you in right now. Deshaun Watson, I'm in Cleveland right now. We're waiting, obviously, for the decision to come down the pipeline on Thursday. But I'm curious, in your mind, we've all dissected, what's the league going to do? Is there going to be an appeal of the 6-game suspension? What will that ultimately mean, and what will it look like? But what do you think at this stage? I think it's interesting that they're going to run the clock out on this. Like, that's what it feels like to me. We're literally going to get to 9 a.m. Thursday before we ultimately find out what the NFL is going to do. But, at this stage, I don't think either way anyone will be surprised. I think it's just now we know what the process is. We've all talked about, if they don't appeal, it is what it is. We're going to move on. Browns are going to prepare, without Watson for 6 games. If they do appeal, we've gone down the road of, what that could look like and maybe federal litigation, yada, yada, yada. This is just becoming a part of our job, I feel like, if you've been doing this long enough.
Yeah, no, it's funny you say that because I haven't been doing it that long, but I started covering the NFL in 2016 in Dallas. And then in 2017, it was like all the Zeke suspension stuff. Again, we're talking about what's going to happen on Wednesday during training camp. With Zeke, it was like he'd be practicing Tuesday, then not on Wednesday. Then they'd get the stay on Thursday. And he wouldn't know from week to week if he was going to play, even though they had those competitive rules. You have to know by a certain day. So while there's some question marks, the Browns are going to have time to respond to this. I think what it comes down to, in my opinion, and I've not looked into the case as deeply as you for sure, is this is much less about Robinson's decision and much more about the system at play. I mean, it's really just like her interpretation. Well, if the NFL is defining things a certain way and she's just responding to it, it's not her moral system. It's her interpretation of this system that's there. And I think it seems like on a lot of levels, the system feels flawed relative to public opinion, and not just public opinion in terms of the masses, but what was it, forward-thinking organization, not a forward-facing, all of that language. Right. I mean, it's a crazy system, and for several reasons, the CBA should lead us to have questions from the last negotiations, and I think this was one of them.
I thought it was fascinating that in her decision, she essentially lays out like, hey, this is serious. Yeah, absolutely. I see this as being a serious issue. Now, there's some argument about nonviolent sexual assault and, how that becomes defined. But she also did say, hey, as defined by the NFL, she put a lot of onus on the NFL when it came to how she arrived at the 6-game decision. But before she got to that point, she was pretty clear. I took this really seriously. And, I did see something that was very problematic. And she really, to say, okay, in the future, Deshaun Watson needs to work with team massage therapists. And, there were a lot of layers there where you're like, man, it feels like she very much leaned into how the NFL was looking at this case. But then when she arrived at the 6-game suspension, the way I interpreted it was she was like, I'm not setting this precedent. Instead, I'm going to look at the precedent you've already set.
Right.
I'm going to look at the other, cases that have come down the pipeline with the NFL. And this is how I'm ultimately arriving at this 6-game suspension. And then she even made the point that you're asking for a 1-year indefinite suspension in which he would have to reapply, which is a different standard than really what you have showcased in the past. And you haven't, and this is paraphrasing here, you haven't really told players that that standard exists.
Right.
And you're essentially, she kind of said, you're sort of making the standard up as you go and expecting players to be able to operate and adhere to it. It was a really interesting way to arrive at, I think, the decision she ultimately did. And I feel like she's caught a lot of flack, but if people are really paying attention to it, she's trying to focus this on, hey, this is kind of an NFL judicial problem, not just a Deshaun Watson problem, not just an independent arbitrator problem. It's looking at the landscape of what's happened and how uneven the application has been from case to case over the years.
For sure. And also, I mean, you see everyone comparing this to Calvin Ridley getting a year for betting for guys like, I've covered Randy Gregory, and there are more a lot in the league who, whether they're smoking marijuana or something, have these indefinite suspensions. Now, even today on the ownership side, we're seeing Dolphins owner Steven Ross being out of the game. But I think the NFL is saying, whether they're meaning to or not, their system says we care about the integrity of the game as it relates to on the field, what can affect competitive advantage. We're not holding our system to the same moral standards. And that's just what they've decided. And I mean, hey, they're a private business. They have that choice, but they should own that choice if they're going to make it.
Yeah. I think I made the point before where I said, look, if you want to start to look at the disparities at, you know, what the NFL takes extremely seriously and attacks, not that they didn't attack this, but they didn't waste a lot of time with Calvin Ridley, right? And what's going on with the NFL right now? They're embracing gambling and, you know, new forms of revenue. And this is a whole, you know, this is a part of the world that the league didn't touch for a really long time. And now it's dicey because they're very much intermingled with it. So they attack the Calvin Ridley situation because it's, hey, that's screwing with a form of revenue that we're now embracing and very much open to criticism in that embrace. And then the Stephen Ross situation, you know, the investigation where essentially they said, look, we think everything that was alleged here, we found that it all occurred except for this one part that sort of leans into the fundamentals of, you know, how quote unquote real and unscripted the game is, or, you know, this idea that we're always, every team's going out there to win every single Sunday. Yeah, we're going to sort of smudge it a little bit and make it sound like, maybe that was just said in passing. And, you know, it's just, it's interesting as you kind of said, where it comes, there's the moral end of it, which is, I think, as she said, maybe forward facing, but not forward thinking. They're very much forward thinking when it comes to anything that really screws with the financial end of it. They're very aggressive
about it. Absolutely. No, I mean, without getting political, it reminds me of some of the Supreme Court nominations with the hearings that we see where people are asked about their views and they're like, well, my job on some people, some of the judges believe their job on the court is not to follow what they espouse. It's to interpret this constitution strictly and as it was intended. And so if the NFL is going to make a system that seems to intend certain rules, it needs to take ownership for that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens on Thursday. It's going to be interesting. As I said, I think they're going to run out the clock and it'll be 9 a.m. Thursday morning when we figure out exactly where this is going. But I did want to ask you about Dallas. I had a chance to come through. Ben, obviously a pretty key injury there in the wide receiver ranks. And actually, I mean, you know, when you really look at the depth chart, it's kind of banged up a little bit. And you said something to me that I have not been able to get out of my head really since I left, where we talked a little bit about, like, when are they going to overcome this? When are they going to turn this around meaningfully and really sort of put a foot forward that you see other organizations put forward without the same history, without the same popularity and all these different things? There are other franchises winning Super Bowls. And, you know, you and I were there when Clarence Hill kind of, you know, asked Jerry, like, what do you celebrate? Like, what are you happy about?
You said successes and failures. So with all due respect, what successes?
Yeah. What successes? Yeah. And, you know, Jerry, you know, definitely, I think it was slight wounding in that, which, you know, rightfully. But you said to me, you talked about the culture. And does the culture need to fundamentally change for this team really to move forward meaningfully? And I had never really thought about it that way with the idea of how they view themselves. But after you had said it to me, I kind of replayed what Jerry had said, where he had talked about focusing on all these positives and stuff. And I was like, man, Jerry's right. Like, there is this element of embracing a sort of culture of greatness that really isn't so great. And maybe that's part of what's standing in the way of the organization at times.
Right. I mean, again, I just happen to really identify with like the blue collar mentality, the grind, like how can you outwork everyone versus just decide you're already there? And I don't think this is a player's issue, to be clear, and certainly not the players coming in. Like, I have no questions about Dak Prescott's work ethic. I think if you see Micah Parsons compete, you know how he's competing and the way he's competing. And there are a lot of guys I could go down the list about that. That said, when you have an owner like Jerry, like you said, being like, look, we're great, when you have the valuation of them being what, $7.5 billion roughly for their value on Sportico this week. And you see, okay, well, James Washington goes down at receiver, they're thin. And Jerry's telling us today, I don't feel any urgency to bring another veteran in. And I mean, you just don't always see decisions being made in what appears to be the best interest of winning. And I think that's challenging. I think that until you have that, the league is too much of a league of parity to overcome that. A lot of times you can't put yourself at a disadvantage because disadvantages are going to come. And And we just haven't seen that. And I think, again, even getting a quarterback like Dak in the room might be the leader you want and might be that caliber of top 10 quarterback that you need. If you don't give him any tools to work with or the coaching at certain times in his career that he needs, I think it's not that he's not taking responsibility. It's that you're not setting him up to win.
And not only that, I think it would be different if there wasn't $20 million of available. I mean, look, there's availability to make moves. Now, I get it. I'm not a fan of, you know, teams, unless it's by design, necessarily pressing themselves up against the salary cap and maxing it out before the, you know, before the season even starts, particularly knowing that, hey, look, at the end of camp, some individuals might become available that you didn't necessarily think would be. And then obviously the trade deadline's far more active now. So I like having some of that cap ammunition there, you know, rolling it over, extensions, all these different things. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But, you know, as you said, with the Washington injury, you know, Michael Gallup pretty much being like, hey, yeah, I don't know if it's realistic. I'm going to be out there.
Yeah, he will not be out there first.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm like, I just don't know offensively. I don't see how this team can realistically be better. And even some of the, and you know more about the team than I do, but look, I saw the spark at times of Pollard, right? And I get the idea of not only fans wanting to embrace that, but you know, reporters asking the question like, okay, you kind of see the gear change here. But then Jerry comes out and says, basically says, look, I feel like a lot of the bulk of what happens in the backfield still has to go through this guy.
Right.
And at times that feels like stubborn. It just feels stubborn. That's, I don't know how else to process it than just to be like, this feels like a stubborn statement.
Yeah, we see a lot of stubbornness out here, a lot of intransigence. You start to get all of the thesaurus words very familiar because you're constantly using them. And again, if he had said, we're not using our cap space because we want to save room for CeeDee Lamb, Trayvon Diggs, Micah Parsons coming up.
Right.
And so we need guys to step up. We need guys to really like take it to the next level. Like, they do say some of that, but I think there's a difference between saying we're going to rely on people to step up than, well, we didn't need Randy Gregory. We didn't need Amari Cooper. Right. No, you didn't need them. You don't have them. Live in the reality that you have, but be realistic about it and be realistic about the work it's going to take to get there. And I don't think that it should always be this like salesman. We have it, what we need, and we're better than we were last year. Like, on what metric are you better than you were last year? Like, Dak's shoulder is better than it was last year when he sprained it in training camp. But I don't think that deceiving, I think Jerry does it to try and sell the fans, and he's clearly an incredible businessman. But at some point, you start to deceive players into being where they were. I did a story recently with Vikings general manager Kwesi Adofo-Mensah, and he was talking about, he said, so he was talking about this talent threshold, and he's like, you need a certain level of talent to win in the NFL. Like, you could, you're usually a little above it or a little below it, but if you're not there, it's really hard to win a Super Bowl. And he said, one of the worst decisions you can make in this league at general manager is deceiving yourself thinking you're there. Now, I will say, Jerry the owner and Jerry the general manager, in theory, are relatively different parts of him. And maybe when he's giving this sales pitch, it's Jerry the owner who wants to sell tickets more than Jerry the general manager. But if you can't keep those straight and you're making personnel decisions accordingly, you can get a little confused and not necessarily always make decisions that are going to lead to the best chance to win.
Well, and there's, come on, you and I have seen like ironclad examples of Jerry the salesman overriding even Jerry the general manager. That, I'm telling you, the draft, it still blows my mind the moment he held up the draft. He's like, hey, yeah, you know, we took the kid out of Tulsa and you guys all thought we were going to take a guard.
Oh, yeah.
And he holds up the first. And I'm literally sitting there and I'm looking at Will McClay and I'm looking at Steven and I'm looking and, you know, and Mike and McCarthy. And you're just like, this is one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen, because you're literally exposing something that is guarded like a nuclear seed. And there are still individuals on that list who are going to be there in the second round. Like, I'm like, you don't have to sell that pick to this point that you're holding something up to the media. And you don't see that in other organizations where you have an individual who has his brains in two different worlds. And then sometimes it's like, I'm going to go ahead and sacrifice this world for this one because I need to make a point. It's just, it's remarkable to me. But I had never really thought about the idea of shifting off, particularly, you know, amongst the front office and Jerry and ownership, this idea of shifting off of the culture of believing what you are versus understanding and not deceiving yourself into really what you are. You brought up Dak's shoulder That was the one thing that I thought coming out of there. I still haven't done my notes from the visit. It's ridiculous. I always try to, like, you know, get a little distance, make some calls afterward. Clearly his shoulder was more screwed up last season than we were kind of led. Anyone was really led to believe. Like, I think it was more of a lingering, at least me personally. Mm-hmm. The way that they kind of poo-pooed it, particularly down the stretch when people are pointing out, like, hey, something doesn't seem completely right here. It feels like now in hindsight, you're starting to get, at least me personally, starting to get the, yeah, it was probably worse than maybe, you know, it lingered a lot longer than maybe we thought it would have over the course of the season.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. I'm more inclined to think that if there was a lingering injury, it was the calf injury he suffered week six, or was it week seven, maybe, against New England just before their bye week. I think that his footwork in the pocket was not what he wanted it to be, and not what it afterward, and not what it had been early in the season. So I didn't think it was so much of an arm strength thing. I will say, though, where the shoulder really came into play is that it pretty much, so he had the whole rehab offseason from his compound fracture and dislocation of his ankle. He's finally going to be able to, like, throw, get his timing with chemistry and chemistry with the receivers in real time at training camp. And then I believe it was the first padded practice last year that he suffers this strain. And so then he can't throw with them again. And then the timing's off. So we've been talking with, I asked CD Lamb about this today, when they keep talking about cadence and pace of operation and getting on the same page. And it's not just about the snap, although as anyone who watched the last play of their season knows, they need to work on the snap. It's not just about the offensive line. It's really about if the receivers are off even like a tick late, then they and Dak are no longer on the same page, and they really need to have those reps for the timing. And so having Dak with no lower body injuries, knock on some kind of wood around here, something falls over as I say that, having, on one hand, you have him healthy to do all of this. On the other hand, you don't have Michael Gallup. You don't have James Washington. Amari Cooper and Cedric Wilson aren't here anymore, and they had 1,400 yards and 14 touchdowns last year. So yet again, you might see that the timing isn't where it needs to be. And that's all the more reason why, if you're going to bring in a veteran receiver, contrary to what Jerry told us today, do it now so you can get their timing down.
Right. And do you think he's, I know he's, you know, downplaying it. Do you think that's real? I look at that depth chart and I'm like, this is serious. Like, this is really, like, I guess in my mind, I'm like, they've got to just be slow playing this. And, you know, they've identified a move that they're going to make, because I just don't see the hodgepodge of, like, hey, let's, you know, make it work with this, you know, group. It's going to be, you know, rotating guys in and trying to find what we can behind CeeDee Lamb. That's a horrible way to start.
Right. This situation. I mean, they tried that in 2018 and they ended up trading for Amari Cooper during their bye week at the deadline for a first round pick, and they needed him. And then I think they forgot that 2 years later. So what I will say about Dak's pass catchers is that you have Dalton Schultz coming off a really productive career year at tight end. You have Tony Pollard, who they've been saying for years they want to involve him more in the passing game, but I do think this will be the year that we see that. I think that they still want Zeke to kind of pound, pound, pound. And again, going back to the stubbornness, like you said, whether it's stubborn or not, they still want that as long as he's relatively healthy. And so getting Tony Pollard out on the perimeter, allowing him to use that explosiveness. They brought in Kevontae Turpin, who was the USFL MVP this year, last week. And he'll probably be more returning, but I think he'll be able to add a little bit of explosiveness. So I think their receiver depth, or their pass catcher depth, is more than their receiver room looks like on paper. But it's still really thin. And still, a lot of teams around the NFL have the receiver room and the tight end and the running backs and someone who's coming in for a package. So I don't think that they should feel comfortable with what they have right now. And I think $40 million a year or not, it's unrealistic for Dak Prescott to be able to perform at the level he did last year with this cast.
You think Pollard plays more in the slot this year?
I think he does. I think especially if it works. I mean, hey, there were times last year when he was awesome. He was ripping off super long runs, finding the end zone. And there were times where he really wasn't able to get off the line like he needed to. I think part of that had to do with the offensive line, whether it was the coverage of Dak or it was creating the run lanes. And that's going to be something we have to look for. But I think that they will at least try to put Tony in those situations. And if he can succeed, he'll continue to get the opportunities.
You know, being there that first day and kind of listen to Jerry initially launch into his speech and immediately, you know, talk about backing Mike, and he wouldn't be, you know, I had options and Mike's here and all these different things. And then listening to him for the remainder of it, basically say, like, hey, I think we're going to be viable in the playoffs, and, like, you know, pretty much map out what the expectations were. I know Mike doesn't want to talk about Sean Payton. Like, I get it. I know he doesn't want to talk about his job, all these different things. But unfortunately, it is real. It is a reality. I mean, you're not going to get away from it. And Mike did at one point, probably in a moment of weakness, admit during the offseason that, hey, yeah, it is a little weird to be in this kind of an organization where you know your owner, you know, right, likes a guy and like, but I mean, and but when Mike, I remember when Mike said it, I'm like, no, he gets it. Like, he's right. He's totally like, I can't. How many times do I look at Mike sitting up there next to Jerry at the table and I'm, and you know, Jerry's doing something crazy and I'm always looking at Mike's face like,
yeah,
you know, because he's like
Mike's face in the draft room when Jerry held up the draft board, like we made eye contact. That's exactly what I thought about when you said that. And he's like, I mean,
like, is this real? Like, am I really here right now?
What's going on? And it's so different than what he encountered in Green Bay. And he's usually pretty diplomatic about it. I think over the years he's got, or I know he's only been here a few years, he's gotten more comfortable at least saying kind of euphemistically, like, things are done differently around here. And then it's like, you guess what that means when he says that. But it is unusual. And I mean, we talked to Jerry Sweeney. You were there, Charles. We had like an hour-long press conference with Jerry, Steven, and Mike McCarthy. And then Jerry's talking to the side after, and we're asking him about this whole other head coach narrative, including the one that he had put forth that defensive coordinator Dan Quinn could potentially be his head coach. And Jerry's like, oh, I was playing poker. And we're like, that makes no sense. And then he was saying like he wanted other teams to think that Dan would be his head coach so he could keep him as coordinator. And I just wrote about this today, and I talked to Dan for a while about it, but like, there really is a difference, and this sounds cliche, between what's going on the like, I know I say the culture because I think it can't completely be separated. I also think, though, that the actions of the coaches and the players say something different than the actions of the front office and of Jerry in specific. And so you kind of have to reconcile what that means. It's definitely unusual that Jerry would talk as openly. I think that he kind of says what he wants and he says everything and it's opposite. So it just depends where you go in an interview. Like, we're doing everything we can and we have exactly what we need and we have the best team ever. I mean, you just pick your clip and it's there, like what you want. So it's interesting, but I think that Mike has finally just been like, all I can do is laugh about this and try and get my team ready to go win. And that's what I'm going to try and do.
I had an editor long time ago. I don't remember who he was referring to, but he once called it sailing without a map. And I'm like, yeah, that's Jerry. He's like, often sailing without a map. Definitely check out Jory's piece on Dan Quinn, by the way. It was a great piece, especially when you consider sort of what he went through after the Atlantic experience, how taxing that was on him. I will say this about Dan. I went through Broncos camp and I can tell you he really, really gave them
a
difficult decision. Like they really, it was tough for them not to. And I can tell you this, I really feel like if they felt, you know, that Hackett hadn't quite killed it the way that he did in an interview, if, you know, they really liked Hackett, they really liked Kevin O'Connell.
Yeah.
But, you know, Quinn was that one like steady, like just experience, his mentality, you know, the confidence that he brings into a room.
Right.
It really, really made it difficult for Denver. And I think, you know, people should understand it was close. It was very, very close. And it leads me to believe when I hear that, when I go through Denver, he's going to get this opportunity. Like if it's not ultimately in Dallas, I mean, who knows what happens with Mike and whether or not the Sean Payton stuff ever comes to fruition or whatever, but Dan's going to get another opportunity. I don't have any question about that. And I think defensively, he's extremely talented. He's going to continue to showcase that. They have the pieces that they have. So, I mean, it's like I said, read the piece. It's a fantastic piece. And I mean, do you suspect like this is going to be a head coach prop?
Right.
Probably maybe even next year. I mean, it's a real possibility.
No, it's true what you say about Denver. And I remember even like season wasn't even over last year. I probably shouldn't have said that. But there when there was a chance that Denver was going to be looking for its next head coach, I was getting calls from people within the organization being like, hey, you're around Dan a lot. Like, what is that experience? Like, what's he like? And I was like, yeah, he's the real deal. I mean, I leave interviews smarter than I got into them with him. And that's just what he's showing on the outside. And then you hear the way the players are talking about his scheme, about his culture, about the way he mentors. I mean, and they had come from a year where Mike Nolan was a super nice guy in 2020 when we worked with him, but it did not work. And that's what Dan Quinn walked into. So I do think so. I think that what I have so much respect for about him, and I talk about this in my piece, is so he gets fired in Atlanta in 2020 after 5 games. And then he's got this time until January when he coaches. So he went through all his Seattle years. He went through his Atlanta years. And he said, both on and off the field, what do I need to change? He's like, how has the game evolved? What's Baltimore doing now that I wasn't doing on my defense? What's Chicago doing, or whoever it was, not that I'm not doing on my defense? And he actually was saying, I didn't include this in the story, that He's like, I had to like pretty much remake all my cut-ups for my teaching tapes because I wasn't doing the same thing anymore, because what I did anymore was so zone focused, and the game, it was just allowing these spread offenses to go, the quarterbacks to get the ball out. And I wanted to be more aggressive and not just let them have what they wanted to do. And so he really thought about, how can we play more man? How can we be more multiple? How can we have these disguises, and implemented that in Dallas? And similarly off the field, he went through a very thorough process with people he'd worked with, saying, tell me what I did wrong and what I can do better. And he still does that with his players here. He told them before they left for their off day this week, you all have to write down by 5 p.m. something we can do better in the next few days and something you want me to work on. And I think when you put all that together, that's the type of leader and schematic person you want to coach. And the last thing I'll say on that is, he was telling me about these notebooks he had, because he had told us back in January, he's like, in my next life, I'm coming back as an offensive coach because I have all these ways I want to beat the defense because they keep making this game so pro offense with the rules. So I asked him, I was like, do you actually have that list? He's like, yeah, I've got a notebook. Like, whoever my offensive coordinator is, I'm going to be like, here are things that I think we need to do based on how this game's evolved. So one day I hope we get it right about what's in that notebook, because I think it'll be pretty exciting for fans to see.
By the way, there are whistles behind Jory right now. That's, you get the full, you get the full training camp experience.
Got some stretching. Yeah.
No, it's crazy too, because I feel like when I see the coaches that get a second opportunity and are successful at that second opportunity, in the gap, they realistically challenge themselves to change, you know, and in a way kind of reinvent themselves. And, you know, some coaches do it within, like McVay is a good example. Like, McVay went through what he went through early in that organization, kind of hit a period where it was a grind for him. And then he figured out how to sort of reinvent what he wanted to do moving forward and how he dealt with the team. He did that without ever leaving a job. Most coaches tend to get fired and then have to do it. You know, Mike McCarthy is a good example. I mean, he's another guy who, you know, had to rethink, at least in some, you know, aspect, what he wanted to do and you know, what he would do differently a second time around.
And the last thing I was going to say, I mean, I think the Rams are such a good example, because one of the things Dan was talking about, he's like, I want my second chance essentially, but with the right partnership, with the right vision, with GM and owner. And I think that's something that worked so well for Sean and Les. Is, I was talking to someone the other day about how, because one of the things that Kwesi had said in our Viking story was like, you never want to go full Rams, but he doesn't believe in that sort of like, we can make it work in 1 year because of the probabilities of what could happen in the NFL. So we need to give ourselves a broader window. And one of the reasons that it worked for Sean and Les is because they just really figured out their unique way to exploit the system. They were so on the same page about it, and they figured it out, not just what they wanted to do, but how they wanted to do it. And so I think that works there. And similarly, Dan's like, here's what I want to be on the same page of with whatever team ownership and general manager I go to. And if we don't see eye to eye, that's like, then it doesn't really matter. Not that it doesn't matter. It's harder to win, even if a coach has retooled, if they're not on the same page as ownership.
Right. Yeah. And I also think that's the reinventing yourself isn't just about scheme. It's not just about how you deal with players. It's also your relationship with ownership, your general manager, and how to navigate a lot of things that maybe you didn't understand the first time around. So definitely check out Jory's piece. Check out all of her stuff, by the way. Follow her on Twitter. Thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. Hopefully we can get you on again at some point this season. I hate that I only see you. I feel like I only see you now because I just don't go to Dallas games like I used to.
Yeah.
I only see you in training camp. So I'm like, hey, how you doing?
Was it like at the Senior Bowl? Didn't we see each other in the tower where the coaches and scouts sit?
Yeah. Up top watching everybody. Yeah. So hopefully we can have you on again and we can talk about, you know, all things Cowboys and Jerry's, you know, whatever his state is in that moment will always be entertaining. So thank you for coming. All right, I'm here with Mike Kliss, obviously Broncos insider for 9 News, longtime Broncos insider Mike Kliss, who I have really, really enjoyed getting to know Mike over the years. I always enjoy coming through training camp, getting a chance to see you, catching up a little bit. Wish we could start off on a better note today. The Tim Patrick injury, obviously really tough. The ACL tear there. Before we get into, you know, maybe some of the things that I thought I saw and everything, I was just wondering if you could, I guess, kind of recap what happened and how that sort of changes the dynamic now for that offense.
Yeah, it was a busy day. It started with they're adding Sir Lewis Hamilton, the Formula One champion, to the ownership group. And then two guys actually went down. First was Demaria Crockett, who played 12 games for him last year.
Yeah, special teams guy.
Number 4, number 3 running back. he was just running down the field. You know, today was the first day of full pads, Charles. They had two ACL injuries, and neither one was on contact. Kind of interesting. But Demaria Crockett was the first. He was running down on special teams coverage drill, and he planted, and there it went. There went the knee. MRI confirmed ACL tear. Tim Patrick actually made a tremendous catch. He went up kind of like that Lynn Swann Super Bowl catch, if you will, that everyone has seen a million times. Didn't have the bobble, though. He went up over Asang Bassey, who was a smaller slot corner, caught the ball, Russell Wilson. Russell kind of threw it on purpose, a little short and high for Tim to go up and get it against the smaller cornerback.
Yeah.
And he came down, and at first I thought he landed awkwardly because all of a sudden he was down in pain. Then I saw a little bit of it, and he came down fine, it looked like. He was clean. He took a couple steps, and then he went down. And I don't know if it was a delayed reaction, ACL on the landing, or he got his cleat stuck in the turf trying to push off after the landing. I don't know, but he clutched his right knee. Hackett stopped the practice, and you know the whole team kind of ran over there to him. And waiting for the cart to come over. He could not put any weight on his right leg. Went for an MRI. We saw him leave with a brace and crutches. Someone drove him out of the facility. But he's out for the year. And, you know, what I think is, on top of all that, they've lost a top receiver each of the past 3 years.
Yeah.
Cortland Sutton gained 2 against the Steelers in 2020, out for the year. I'm not sure he's all the way back to 2009, Cortland Sutton. You know, he's showing signs of being back. He got a lot of the way back last year, but not all the way back. KJ Hamler, game 3 last year, their speed guy. Similar type thing. He landed awkwardly, messed up his hip. He opened up about the dark place he was in mentally and emotionally yesterday, where he thought about, you know, leaving the earth, leaving the world. And, he's coming back. He's still not cleared for contact. He's activated from the PUP, but he's not participating in team drills. And now Patrick. So if Cortland is 100% and KJ Hamler is 100%, then they're going to be okay replacing Tim Patrick because Jerry Jeudy gets more targets now. He doesn't. Right. He's not pushed by Tim Patrick or has to share with Tim Patrick. There's more balls for Jerry Jeudy. More balls for Cortland Sutton. And that's where they overtake and overcome this injury to Tim Patrick. And KJ Hamler's also returns 100%. But after that, I do believe there's a drop-off. And so Kendall Hinton, who people remember for playing quarterback against the Saints a couple weeks ago, Tyree Cleveland, special teamer, speed, hasn't quite developed as a receiver as they hoped coming out of Florida, but he was making great strides. And now he's been nicked up with a couple of injuries. And then the rookie they like, Montrell Washington, little guy, going to be their returner, a terrific returner. So he's on the roster. And the plan was for him to not do much as a receiver this year. But now, you know, maybe you accelerate that a little bit. So we'll see. And then we'll see if George Payton, who is never satisfied and is one of the great tinkerers, roster tinkers in the league, see what he does between now and season opening. If he does anything, I could see him making a claim, you know, as all those cuts come down for the 53-man roster.
I wonder, you know, just from having been through there and talking to Coach Hackett and George Payton about sort of focusing it through Russ, I know Patrick's one of those guys that they felt like, hey, you know, could be a stride forward guy. Working with Russ, you know, people have talked about Jerry Jeudy. Russ talked about bringing, you know, Jeudy into the quarterback meetings. What's your sort of sense on where he's at in that continuum? Because I almost wonder now with Patrick going down, obviously it elevates, I don't want to say pressure, but certainly the expectation is there that, okay, now, you know, you're going to have an opportunity that's a little more unfettered to catch balls and be a bigger part of this offense, which I think they would be really happy with, but it still felt like they were a little measured in terms of where they were viewing, you know, where he was.
Yeah, I think Jeudy felt pressure by being the first round draft pick, and Justin Jefferson, and who was selected after him, and C.D. Lamb in the same draft, having way bigger numbers. And so I really think in some ways this might free Jerry Jeudy a little bit. I think he was, you know, he kind of looked at the way it was in the base. Patrick was starting with Sutton. Those were the top two.
Right.
Jeudy was the number three to start training camp. Some of that was because Jeudy had a really bad off season. He had a domestic case against him that was dropped, but still had occupied a couple of weeks of his time. He had injuries to his back and his groin. And so he never got a chance to stack any days together. He did have a couple of nice days going into today in the Patrick injury with Russell Wilson. It almost looked like Wilson was trying to feed Jeudy's confidence by throwing him the ball a little bit. And it seemed to be working. You know, Jeudy had a couple of nice days. So I think with Jeudy not having to worry about sharing with Tim Patrick, this is going to be really good for him. This is the only way for the Broncos to overcome Tim Patrick is if Jerry Jeudy has the type of year that he was drafted for, that people thought. And right now it's us, and not only us in the media, but the fans, his own teammates, the people upstairs, we got to see it to believe it. He right. hasn't done it yet. He's frankly, for whatever, you know, last year it was mainly injury and coming back from that, but he hasn't quite lived up to expectations yet. And we'll see if this helps him. I hate to take anything away from Tim Patrick, who is a loss. He's their best blocking receiver on top of everything else. He's got fire. He hates the Raiders. He brings that passion, to the locker room. He's liked because he was an undrafted underdog.
Yeah.
Come out of Utah, compound fracture early in his college career. Spent a year, if not two, on the practice squad and emerged to a 50-catch guy. But you ought to be able to replace a 50-catch guy if you're a championship team or a playoff team. And let's see if they can do it.
What do you think? I'm just curious what you think of the sauce. I mean, I you come in, and I think I mentioned this to you when you and I were standing there, just this idea of new ownership, which we'll kind of see what that looks like moving forward. But George Payton, new head coach, you know, new general manager, new head coach, new coordinators, all this in the span of like 18 months. I was struck by, I mean, I knew a little about Hackett. I hadn't spent, you know, much time really with Hackett before he got to Denver, but I did know sort of his perception through a guy like Aaron Rodgers, which it's very interesting to me how much Aaron Rodgers gravitated toward him, felt about him, felt motivated by him, where, you know, Aaron is not always that kind of guy when he's working with different coaches. And yet I knew this was a guy that was going to be really different than Vic Fangio. And just the limited amount of time I had, you know, spent talking to him, I was a little blown away by, wow, it's even more opposite than I even could have thought. What do you think though, just about this mixture of different, you know, personalities, because he and Peyton aren't really one for one guys. I mean, they're very sort of yin and yang in some ways. Russ is his own kind of interesting individual. Like I kind of always tease Russ saying like, you know, the answers feel like they're coming out of vending machines and stuff. But Russ is he's a really good player. There's no question about that. He absolutely can lead on the field. This collection, now that you've had a chance to kind of see it, albeit very limited in camp, how do you feel about it versus maybe how you felt about it as it was coming together in the offseason?
Yeah. First of all, what I would say about all these changes in the last 18 months and then really the last 5 months, Peyton was 18 months ago, Hackett, Russell Wilson, and ownership were here, you know, with more compact here this year.
Right.
It had to happen. It you know, things were getting stale here. Elway had a terrific first 5 years as a GM. Didn't work out, I think, because of the Paxton Lynch is where most people put the blame. Gary Kubiak getting sick. It's one thing after another. John got a little stale. They had to replace him. They replaced a guy who was bigger than the Broncos almost in Elway.
Right.
With a guy who was a scout, who was gets in at 6:30 and watches tape of third string guards on the Carolina Panthers. You know, that's what George Payton is. That's the kind of GM he is. And he understands all the mechanisms of the waiver wire, and administratively, he's very strong, very meticulous. Last year, there's no doubt in my mind, he made the most transactions with players 51 to 53 on the roster than any GM in football last year. It was amazing how he kept shaking up the back end of his roster. And he watched film and evaluate and go through all that. So it was, George Payton was good because he was different than John Elway. Then you bring in Hackett, and I think Fangio is a terrific coach, but he's not a high energy coach. He surrounded himself with guys just as old as he was, who were veterans who had been around, and they also didn't have the most energy. And so in comes Hackett. You know, he's got all this youthful enthusiasm, and he takes handoffs from Russell Wilson in practice, and he plays safety on the back end, and, you know, and in meetings, he's, you know, bubbling over. And that's the type of energy that I think this team needed as a 180 from Vic Fangio. And on top of that, Hackett brought in a very, very young, if not young, extremely inexperienced coaching staff by design, following the Green Bay Packer model. You look at the Packers coaching staff, and you look at their coaching roster, you never heard of these guys 3 years ago. Hackett's belief is you take young guys and you mold them to coach the way you want them to coach. You know, Pat Shurmur knows how to coach, but it was going to be hard for Hackett to teach Pat Shurmur, you got to coach him this way after right. Shurmur's been in the league 30, 40 years, you know. So he's got all these young guys, and they're going to coach the players the way he wants them to coach. And he's so invested in this wide zone West Coast system. Very, you know, he told me he had chances at about five or six other jobs 3 years ago. And he picked the Packers because this is the offense he wanted. You know, of all the offenses he's been around, and he's been around his dad, who was an offensive coordinator, he knows all about the West Coast. But this particular wide zone blocking system is what he wants for his offense. So you have that. Now, he's an alpha male, but I think he's got a chance to be special because when they hired him, I thought, man, I'm not sure that this, Ted Lasso style, if you will, is going to work in the NFL after a 2-game losing streak. But he's very smart. The more you meet him, he's very smart. He has a way of pushing buttons to get guys to play. You know, I think he can get up into a guy's face if he has to. Haven't seen it yet. But I think he's got a style that demands respect and will demand respect from the players. So I think that's good. And then Russell Wilson, he's the personality that you got to get used to because, I mean, he's way off the charts in asserting leadership. And, you know, to the point where, you know, he's by the textbook of how you lead as a quarterback.
Right.
You know, if you read it in sixth grade, this is how you be a quarterback. This is what you do. Russell Wilson follows that. He's got all the, the axioms. He knows how to talk to the press. He knows how to talk to the people. Some people question his how genuine he is. And I can see where people do that. But I think, Russell, it's about being a professional. And so far, how that's all going to mesh, that is going to be interesting. You can't have any more days like today. I know that.
Right.
But, you know, compared to where they were and how miserable the last 5 years were. And then, I really think Joe Ellis did a good job running the team as a trustee, as a controlling owner delegee for Pat Bowlen. But I guess he didn't have the right coach. You know, they didn't have the right roster. And so he didn't look good as an owner. He did the first 5 years as an owner delegee, but not the last 5 years. And so. The Penner-Walton group comes in with the GM, who's in his second year of a 6-year contract, with a coach who's 5 months into a 4-year contract, and Russell Wilson, who has 2 years left on his contract and probably is going to have a 4-year extension sooner rather than later. And so the new ownership group comes in pretty good shape with this team. The four pillars are ownership, GM, head coach, and quarterback. And right now, all four are just starting those pillars. And it looks like they're in pretty good shape with those pillars.
When you sit there and you think about kind of that changeover with John and obviously Joe Ellis, I thought it was interesting that you don't get to see a general manager who literally makes a head coaching hire pretty much as on his own as George ended up being, because of the fact that, you know, Joe Ellis was transitioning out and it was sort of like, hey, this is going to be your choice, man. Like, this is, you know, you're the one who's going to be here with this guy. And you didn't have ownership kind of leaning on the hire. And you don't often see general managers who literally are kind of making the choice unilaterally.
Not only that, John Elway, the outgoing GM, was in on the interview process. He interviewed George. That
doesn't happen. No, that definitely doesn't. In terms of the stewardship, though, what do you think is the most is it like, who's the fundamental, like, sort of touchstone piece in the middle of all this? Who's going to make, as this moves forward? Is it George? Like, is George spine of it?
It is George. And we'll see what Greg Penner, by the way, is going to be the guy running the day to day, the line of authority for the ownership group. It's Rob Walton's going to be living in Scottsdale and flying in on game day, which is what Kroenke kind of does in LA, which is what Wilf does with Minnesota, and Ross won't be doing in Miami for a couple of months. Penner's going to be in charge overseeing this operation. But Penner doesn't know what he doesn't know yet. And I think he's smart enough to understand that. And, I think from what he's gathered, and he's done his research and homework, he has confidence that George is good. And he's been told that George is the guy. And so George does have his thumb on the whole operation football-wise. It is George Payton's show, as it was John Elway's show previously. George just takes more of a laid-back approach to it. When John walks in the through the hallways, everybody kind of moves to the walls, you know.
Right.
When George moves through the hallways, you know, it's everybody just kind of mingles. He, you know, gives the fist pump and everything's good. But George is ultimately, and everybody understands this, he does just enough to where everybody knows, Nate Hackett knows, that George is his boss.
There's just so many elements of this that are, you know, first time owners, first time head coach, first time coordinators. You know, I know obviously George has been in the seat, and as you said, now for 18 months, but man, it's just so many.
Yeah.
It's so many new, different experiences. And the point that you made about the coaching staff being young guys you can mold, all these elements, other than maybe Russ, I mean, obviously because Russ has been through it, he's a vet, he's done it with a different, you know, organization at the, you know, in the same position he's filling for the Broncos. But everybody else, I think, is sort of, it feels like a lot of these people are going to be learning together, you know, learning to make that fit, you know, all together, not necessarily having, weirdly enough, the experience that Russ had for a long time in Seattle. So,
Charles, I tell you, I used to always worry about you. You'd come in, you'd have your sources, and you'd have stuff that you'd have that deep inside the building information. But all your sources, I think you found that a lot of your sources are now gone, as I found mine. I got to get a whole new group of sources here.
It's been some change. It's been some change, yeah, definitely.
I've never been through this. And on top of that, you know, at least we're going in the locker rooms this year. I was saying A.J. Boye was here for a year. I'd never met the guy. You know,
That's so bizarre.
I haven't seen any of these guys in 2 years. Tyree Cleveland, who they drafted in 2020. I saw him going in the locker room the other day. I was like, hey, Tyree, Mike Kliss. First time I ever met him face to face.
That's crazy.
Yeah. He's going on his third year.
Yeah.
So, that part's going to help, I think, in the transition for us. But it's a whole new era for the Broncos. And, There's such hope, and really the hope's about Russell Wilson, not necessarily the coach, but no one hates the coach yet. He hadn't lost yet, you know? So it's going to be an interesting year. If the Broncos can compete, that would be good for this region. It's going to be tough though, man. I still got the Chiefs hands down in the AFC West. I mean, Do they not? I know they lost Tyreek, but do they not still have Mahomes and Andy Reid?
Yeah,
and I'm talking about them pillars again.
Yeah,
Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the thing, though. I mean, defensively, they're going to have to deal with some. I mean, the rest of the division, frankly, offensively, has gotten a lot better in the time that the Chiefs have held that top spot. I've kind of told people, like, hey, the rest of the division has done a pretty good job of starting to catch up with some of the changes they've made, particularly offensively. Yeah. And, you know, I'm with you. Like, I went in there and you know, I was kind of joking with George where I'm like, I'm so used to coming in here and every year writing the story about, like, well, is this going to be the quarterback? Like, every year, who's it going to be? Finally, I get in there and it's, you know, that is settled and there's so much excitement. But I find myself kind of, you know, you want to ground yourself and be like, okay, I get it. Like, everybody's really excited, but, you know, I don't know how this is going to turn out. And I, thankfully, that's how George kind of handles things too, where he was just like, we haven't won anything, man. He's like, we've lost 13 in a row to the Chiefs. He's like, when was the last time we were in the playoffs? I'm like, well, okay. Well, at least this, you know, his feet are definitely on the ground. There's no question about that.
He's made some bold moves, you know, with Spielman in Minnesota before and Sam Bradford. I think he was there with Brett Favre when they brought him in for that 1 year. I think that was the start of his regime there. Kirk Cousins.
Yeah.
You know, there's paper and you get lauded and you get a lot of praise in the press, as George has so far with his draft last year and getting Russell Wilson. I mean, he's batting 1,000 and he keeps telling us, you know, I was 7-10. Right now, the only record I got under my name's is 7-10. Right. So that's where he starts. And I'm thinking 10-7 for the Broncos this year, as most people are. That's where Vegas has them. So we'll see.
See, and I got to tell you, Mike, if a 10-7 team, you know, I kind of said this coming out of there, that, like, hey, if a team came out of the AFC North in those years that it was just a brutal division and they were 10-6, right? That was a tough-ass 10-6 team. Yeah. You know, that was a team that was battle-tested. It wasn't a normal 10-6 team. I kind of feel like whoever it is, if it's a 10-7, you know, team and you make the playoffs at 10-7, it's a dangerous, tough 10-7 team. Like, that's not an easy record, okay? That's a really difficult record.
Some of those 10-6 teams gave those 14-2 Peyton Manning teams all
yeah.
the
yeah.
time. Beat them every now and then in the playoffs. So I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope everybody, obviously, you're everybody knows you, Mike, you know, for years has had the market cornered on the Broncos, and you were always the guy who, when I come in, I'm like, well, what do you know versus what do I know? Because I'm trying to connect the pieces. So I'll everybody read Mike, and you know, thank you for everything you do. I appreciate you coming on, man.
Right on. Thanks, Charles.
All right. Hope you enjoyed the lineup today. Thank you very much to Arif Jory and Mike Kliss for coming in and taking time out of their day. It's definitely a grind covering camp every single day. So to get people in at the end of their day really means a lot to us. Definitely check all of them out on Twitter if you could. You can find Arif Hassan at @ArifHassanNFL. Once again, for his Vikings coverage for The Athletic. You can get Jory Epstein at Jory Epstein, JoriEpstein, and Mike Kliss at Mike Kliss, MikeKlis. Please give them a follow. Check out their information. Three of the best NFL reporters for you to check out. So, take a look at their coverage. And if you could, once again, hit up BreakingTea.com/Therese for your All Juice tea or hoodie. Remember that proceeds from that purchase go to the Therese A. Paylor Scholarship at Howard University. You can also donate directly to that scholarship if you check out our podcast description, as well as the one in Therese's name at Power Mizzou. We will be back again next week. Have not nailed down a day yet. Sort of depends on the travel schedule and then some of these other camps that we have set up. But hope you enjoy the format. We'll figure out whether or not maybe we want to have Frank Schwab or someone in as we get a little deeper into camp to discuss maybe the broader storylines and some of the news that's starting to develop throughout the league as we head toward the preseason games. You can get me on Twitter at Charles Robinson. You can get our ace producer, Brett Rader, at Brett Rader as well on Twitter. Shoot us some questions for the next podcast or leave a 5-star review. We would really, really appreciate that. Thanks again for tuning in and sticking with me. Hopefully I'll be over the head cold next week. Look forward to talking to you then.